Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 11th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. In the last weeks, the LaRouche PAC has launched an intense campaign to educate Americans on what is the American system of economics. This is necessary because we have an absolutely absurd presidential campaign with various kinds of discussions of economics which have nothing to do with anything but varieties of the British system. And over the years, LaRouche and his collaborators have been the only serious proponents of what was widely known in the 19th century as the American system of economics. This was based on a principle of natural law, which was written into the U.S. Constitution and put into practice under George Washington's presidency by his Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton. It was explicitly designed to counter the free trade colonial system of the British Empire, which we fought our revolution to defeat. Now, much of the last two centuries of world history has been an unfolding of an ongoing, though often unacknowledged, war between these two systems, the American system and the system of the British Empire. The British imperial system seized control of much of the world's economy following the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy, and what you could call the assassination under Richard Nixon's presidency of Franklin Roosevelt's Bretton Woods system. That British imperial free trade system is collapsing today under the weight of uncollectible debt and insane axioms, and this is the reason we're headed under the British puppet Obama toward a likely World War III if it is not defeated now. Incredibly, many Americans who consider themselves patriots have responded to the collapse of that system by embracing its essential outlook, including those who promote the historically false line that President Andrew Jackson was an opponent of the global bankers and the British system. On our program today, we'll be speaking with author and historian Anton Chaitkin on the real history of the American system, and how Alexander Hamilton was one of its authors, and Andrew Jackson was actually an agent of the imperial bankers who opposed the American system from the beginning. Tony is probably known to many of you who are regular listeners to this program and readers of LaRouche publications. He's the author of several books, including Treason in America, which provides some deep insights into this history. And he's also the co-author of the much-acclaimed, unauthorized biography of George Herbert Walker Bush. He's written numerous articles, one of which will appear in the latest EIR, under the title, Think Like an American, Restore Hamilton's Bank. So, Tony, welcome to the program today.
Hi, Harley. Thank you.
Let's start with one element of this fight, and we will have time to cover the whole history in detail, but I want to begin with the continuing campaign of assassination of Alexander Hamilton, not just the assassination by Aaron Burr, but why has there been such a concerted effort for over two centuries to lie about this great American founding father, to go so far as to accuse him of being a supporter of the very Bank of England model, which he provided an alternative to?
Hamilton solved a crisis, and his point of view was the point of view of the founders of this country and the founding generation, which was a passion for improvement and the setting up of a permanent progress machine with the Constitution and with Hamilton's program for tariffs, for a national bank, for government credits and infrastructure. He solved a crisis, and the Americans solved a crisis in the typical American way of Benjamin Franklin and the Revolution, which was to say, our nation is committed to making a breakout from our then-current agrarian backwardness, to go far, far above that status, and to give unheard-of new powers to a population, machine powers, fuel powers, and other inventions that would change the character of the country.
Now, Tony, at the time of the battles that Hamilton had to get his policies through, there were Americans who took the British view that the United States should remain a backward agrarian power. Would you say this was one of the beginning of the battle that we're still fighting today?
I think that to answer the question, the first question you posed, why the British and their friends are so frantic to re-assassinate Hamilton, is that this idea, how to think like an American, to reach for the stars, which we have done repeatedly to face crises, they want this exterminated, this idea of America, and to blot it out so that they can accomplish genocide in the world. Mm-hmm. And posed a problem for people who were patriots, such as Jefferson and Madison, but who were stuck in a mindset of the plantation and in their education in British philosophy of John Locke and Newton, which the American nationalists rejected. Jefferson and Madison supported the Revolution, but their point of view, as I showed in some letters between them just before the Constitution went in,
right,
their point of view, you'll read it in this article in the EIR coming out, their yeah. point of view was that the agrarian backwardness that they were familiar with in Virginia, which was all over Europe at the time and caused mass poverty in Europe, that this backwardness would continue, might be alleviated by, you know, dividing property up, like Jefferson said, let's take away some of the estates of the rich. But no idea that in a future generation we would go into a massively powered nation. And that
you point out in one of the articles, Madison essentially is arguing that we have to reduce population or at least stop its increase.
He argued that there will always be surplus people, because if given his assumption that there is a static society, you will not need people to produce more than a certain amount to feed and clothe the productive people and all the non-productive people in that kind of society. But if you go a generation ahead, as Hamilton set up the machinery to do with government, direct guidance of credit going into productive manufacturing, productive investment, you have then a level of industrial input that's needed, a level of resource materials, totally new resources, a level of use of processes and machines that was unheard of in Madison and Jefferson's day. And therefore, you need massively more production to sustain that kind of society, which they couldn't even dream of. But Franklin, if you look at his outlook from the 1750s, where he's projecting forward the use of electricity by man more powerful within our society, more powerful than lightning. And he's projecting, he even says, we will perhaps learn how to deprive masses of their gravity. We will overcome the forces of nature. Those are two conflicting points of view.
Tony, let me come back to the first part of that, because I think it's very important that you said Madison and Jefferson were stuck in the philosophy of Locke, and as a result, they had this static view. That put them, just as you were pointing out, accepting the ideas of Malthus.
They did, but... Mr. Madison said explicitly that there will that overpopulation it dooms man to perpetual poverty. But it must be pointed out that as patriots, they fought against Hamilton's program when he was the Treasury Secretary. But later on, when they were in power, they did not take down the Bank of the United States, and they restored it after the initial bank's charter had expired.
What did Hamilton do that they decided ultimately they had to continue?
He set up the Bank of the United States. It had a 20-year charter. And he also actually put It was Hamilton's actions that resulted in Jefferson becoming president. This is an irony, which is very important because...
And it's quite fascinating, the story that you have in the article.
Yeah, the fact is that Jefferson and Madison were advocates of the U.S. joining France in a war on Britain. Washington and Hamilton wanted to avoid war so that the United States could build up its power, trade with Britain on our terms with high tariffs, and to protect our interests. They were not chicken hawks. We did avoid war. And until we were, a generation later, and we were plunged into a second war after our revolution, a second war with Britain.
But the War of 1812.
The War of 1812. It was in that period that the nation was rallied to fight the British militarily and stop, and they invaded us and so forth. It was in that period that Hamilton's views predominated in the Jefferson Party. The Jefferson Party became strong in the 1790s, not because people took Jefferson's side against Hamilton, but because there was a fake party set up by the British element in New England in particular, which called itself the Federalist Party. Which pretended to ally with Washington and Hamilton against Jefferson and recommending that we go on the side of Britain against France.
Now, Tony, this is
that
very
party
important.
Was overthrown by Hamilton.
This is very important because this is where you get the line that goes through what might otherwise be patriotic sorts, but who don't think very well, who argue that Hamilton actually was trying to create a Bank of England in the United States, and this is what the Federalist Party was. Go through just again, what was it? What were the explicit issues between Hamilton and the bankers who later took over the Federalist Party? What was the dividing line?
The actual dividing line was the purpose of the nation and the federal government. And in the eyes of Hamilton, the purpose of federal power, of national power, was to rescue our society from collapse and from being preyed upon and destroyed by the British Empire. Because if we stayed at the level of a backward coastal nation, semi-colonial, exporting our crops to England where they were worked up in manufactures, and we get the manufacturers, the British troops were even on our western frontier. We would have been gobbled up. So the program for manufacturing and for infrastructure and using the credit of the government, the government's power to direct the credit of society into productive investment, saved the country, because if you do not have that power and that intention by the federal government and by the nation to make the credit go in that direction, always the parasitical bankers, the financiers, the old European oligarchy and their friends in places like Wall Street will always suck all the credit of society into gambling and exterminate the society. They will stop productive investment. And that is what they wanted to do at that time.
So Hamilton's conception of credit was explicitly anti-speculative and anti-inflationary. Then.
Exactly. And he used the bank, just as Nicholas Biddle did later, the second bank, to stop attacks by speculators against the buildup of industry in the United States. It has to be pointed out that the Second Bank of the United States was started in 1816 at the request of then-President James Madison, who 25 years earlier had called for Washington to veto the first bank.
What changed his mind, Tony?
What changed his mind was partly the whole experience of the country in fighting the British, our weakness without the bank for a few years after the charter of the first one expired, but also a marvelous book put out by Matthew Carey, Hamilton, Ben Franklin's protege in Philadelphia, the olive branch, which condemned the Jefferson Madison folly and error on following free trade, but also attacked the British agents in the Federalist Party, particularly the Boston Brahmins, for treason. And Jefferson and Madison congratulated him for showing their errors. And this what you know, as late as 1832, when Southern traders were trying to put the United States into a vice of secession and blackmail, Madison pointed out in his old age that anyone who says the government doesn't have the power to direct the trade by high tariffs into protective tariffs, and says that's not in the Constitution, anybody who says that is a fool. I was there at the Constitutional Convention, and that was everybody, all the countries in the world who wanted to advance used protective tariffs, and America would have been the only country to offer itself up as a sacrifice to the empire if we didn't do that. So the fraud comes in when you have this astonishing, peculiar, crazy story that Andrew Jackson, a creature of the enemy, a creature of the British spy system inside the United States, run by Aaron Burr and his friends, that he chased the bankers out of power.
Tony,
the exact opposite is the truth. The exact opposite.
Let's get to that in a moment. I want to just remind our listeners, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's the 11th of February, 2012, and I'm talking with author, historian, and activist Tony Chaitkin, whose article, Think Like an American, which covers the material we're discussing today and more, I think it's already out in the current EIR. And if you're not a subscriber to EIR yet, the EIW, which is a weekly internet publication, you should be in touch with us, call our offices, and pick it up immediately, because this is the kind of material that is essential for the war to save the nation today that we're waging. Now, Tony, before we get to Jackson in particular, I want to make two connections. First of all, the Matthew Carey thing is interesting because you pointed out his book was essentially a bestseller.
Exactly. It had 100,000 copies. You know, my treason book had 100,000 copies, but that was nothing compared to 100,000 back in 1814.
And so this was read by people and discussed and debated and helped to shape the policy of the Madison and then the Monroe administration.
Exactly right.
And I think that's important for those people who listen who say, well, these are ideas, you know, ideas don't matter, gold matters, something hard matters. In fact, our nation is a nation of ideas, and that's one of the points you're trying to make.
Yes. And then the question comes in, what happens if people lose those ideas, as in the time of folly from Andrew Jackson later on?
Let me just make the other connection I want to make then, which is also in your article, the role of Aaron Burr, who someone informed me today that on one of the bumper stickers that's put out by supporters of Ron Paul, they actually have a little picture of Aaron Burr on it and say that he was right. Now, Aaron Burr is a pivotal figure in this, not just because he's the one who killed Hamilton, but because of his connection between this traitorous faction in 1800 and then what happened in the 1820s that we're going to get to in a moment. Just give us a little bit on Aaron Burr. Obviously, people should go to your book, Treason in America, but give us a little sense of what a scoundrel this guy actually was.
In the 19th century, and up until recent times, Americans well knew, it was burned in their memory, the criminal nature, the enemy nature of this scoundrel Burr. He was exposed by Alexander Hamilton in 1804, trying to work with the Boston leaders, Tories, to break up the United States. And he shot Hamilton, killed him in a duel. He had earlier tried to seize the presidency from Jefferson. He had been elected on the assumption that he was going to be vice president. And with Jefferson, it went into the House of Representatives to decide between them. And even though he ran for vice president, he tried to get himself elected president instead of Jefferson. After shooting Hamilton, he was in disgrace. He offered his services to the British ambassador Anthony Mary, saying that he would break the western part of the United States off that had recently been added, the Louisiana Territory, and set up a new empire to ally with Britain. Jefferson had him arrested, and Jefferson also put out a summons for his partner in that treason, Andrew Jackson, who had supplied the boats for Aaron Burr's private army that was to sail down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers to Louisiana to carry out this treason. Jackson came to Richmond for the trial of Burr and denounced President Jefferson as a tyrant for this whole attack on Burr, his partner. Then he was acquitted of treason, because the report of the British ambassador back to London about Burr's offer did not come out until much later. He was still wanted on charges of homicide and felonies in Ohio, and he went to England, declared that he had always been loyal to the British crown, and began to live on and off inside England at the home of Jeremy Bentham, the strategic leader of British intelligence.
It might be added, Jeremy Bentham, who devoted his life to trying to overturn the American Revolution.
Yes, who denounced the Declaration of Independence as an absurdity. In this relationship to Bentham and to British intelligence, Burr quietly came back to the United States in 1812, just before our second war broke out with Britain. At the end of that war, Andrew Jackson was acclaimed a hero for his role in the Battle of New Orleans, a military hero. And at that point, Aaron Burr wrote a letter to his son-in-law, the former governor of South Carolina, saying, "We've got to stop the further ascendancy of the Jefferson Party. We've got to stop these people from Virginia, like Jefferson, who's a schemer, and Monroe, who's about to become president, unless we do something to stop this. These people have been deceiving America." He's talking about Jefferson explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
"What we need to do is put up Andrew Jackson," which nobody would have thought of as a presidential candidate. This is in 1815, right at the end, right after the end of the War of 1812, just
right
after the British had burned Washington to the ground, had burned the White House, had burned the Capitol, had burned the Library of Congress. And he asked his son-in-law, Burr asked his son-in-law to keep this quiet and make it look like it was the son-in-law's project, not Burr's project.
Because if people knew of Burr's connection, it probably would have doomed Jackson.
Exactly right. So Burr had a lieutenant named Samuel Swartout, Swartout, who went with him to England, who introduced him to Bentham, who slipped back into the U.S. with Burr and became Andrew Jackson's political advisor back in 1812. And it was this guy who then, from the inside of Jackson's entourage, got Jackson going in 1824 as a candidate, having him denounce John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay, and carrying out Burr's project to make him a national figure running for the presidency.
Now, in the meantime, though, what had happened is that there was the rechartering of the Bank of the United States, and this was what shaped the period of the Monroe administration, and then especially John Quincy Adams, with his idea of the development of the entire continent. Give us a little bit of a sense of that, because I believe you have an unpublished manuscript still that covers a lot of this material.
Yes, John Quincy Adams was the high point of this whole revival of Hamilton's policies within the Jefferson Party. And his idea was to reach for the stars, literally. He wanted to make mankind in the image of Plato's ideals for man, explicitly. And under his presidency and using the powers of the national government given by Congress in 1824, the General Survey Act, he assigned Army engineers to design the first 60 railroads of this country. The Bank of the United States under Nicholas Biddle presidency, who had been installed as president of the bank by President Monroe, cooperated and Moore led the way with his partner between the bank and the presidency and the army and strategists in all these fields to build up completely new industries that began to change the began to industrialize the country at that point.
You gave some of these figures that were astounding to me about the development of the coal industry.
Yeah, they started the coal industry in 1819. There was zero commercial production of coal in the United States. Zero. And they decided they would spring anthracite coal into production. They had to promote it very hard. Because it was so effective that people thought it would it could only be ignited at a higher temperature. They thought it would put fires out. And they built a massive canal network inside the state of Pennsylvania and railroads, all of it sponsored by the Bank of the United States and with money from the state. This was devoted to getting the coal out of the ground and to the ports, and to the cities, and to the industries.
Now, Tony,
the Tumas Coal came up with this. The tariffs protected iron. We developed an iron industry for the first time since the colonial days, and so forth.
Now, Tony, I want to just take one. It's a slight side route here, but I think it's important because of the lies and slanders, again, about the Bank of the United States. There are a lot of books that have been written and stories out there among the conspirophile types who say that what Biddle did was nothing but crony capitalism, that he used the bank to enrich a small group of friends. And this is part of the argument that goes also against Hamilton. I'd like you to just dispel that quickly.
There's two things you have to look at. First of all, the intention of the nation, which was united behind this, including John C. Calhoun from South Carolina, to break out of backwardness using the powers of the federal government, the tariffs, the national bank, and infrastructure, to break out of that. That was backed by everybody except traders in the 1820s. And Martin Van Buren and others in the Burr machine set up a new party against this national unity, and they called it the Democratic Party. It was an alliance of the anti-nationalist Virginians with Wall Street. Now, at that point, when Jackson was convinced by Van Buren that his enemies ran the Bank of the United States, he was a fool. He didn't know anything. He didn't get elected to take the bank down. He campaigned as a nationalist in the North and as a states' rights guy in the South. His managers did that.
That was Jackson's 28
Jackson.
Campaign?
Yeah, the 28 campaign. But when he was convinced to take this bank down, to pull the deposits out of the bank, the Bank of the United States, the federal deposits, and to veto Congress's vote to recharter it. At that point, they set in motion a weakness in the United States that the British jumped into immediately. The Bank of England withdrew its credits from the United States. When the new president, this scoundrel Van Buren, came in as president in 1837, the weakness of the U.S. economy without protection in a stable currency went into the most profound plunge and chaos and disaster. At that moment, two things occurred. The South assumed power in our nation's economy and politics. And from that point, from the point when Jackson had destroyed national power, until Lincoln came in 1861, the United States was ruled to its ruin by Southern plantation slavery and by the bankers that came in Wall Street, in alliance with Wall Street. The other thing that happened at that moment, a few days after the 1837 panic began, August Belmont, the trainee and cousin of the Rothschilds, arrived in New York City from Europe, knowing that this new Van Buren Democratic Party was in control and was ruining the United States, was taking the power out of the nation. And he set up in New York City the agency that would represent the Rothschild interests and implicitly the British Empire interests in Wall Street as a colony of England. People have to understand that Andrew Jackson, in his foolishness, appointed the Rothschild Bank as the official agency for financial affairs operating in Europe, the agency of the U.S. government. In my article, I have a photograph from the website of the Rothschild family, and you can look this up yourself on the internet. It's a portrait that was given to the Rothschilds, a portrait of Andrew Jackson, and it's a thank you note by the Rothschilds. This website entry, a thank you note to Andrew Jackson for giving control to them and their British financial colleagues over the United States of America.
See, Tony, I think this is one of the things that jumped out to me about the article. I mean, there are two things that I think are important, and we still have half the program to flesh this out more. I want to remind people this is the LaRouche Show. It's February 11th, 2012. This is a discussion that goes far beyond an article that's coming out this week for Executive Intelligence Review, but that's a good place to start. But two things that jumped out to me. One was, again, just this continuity on the one side, the good side of the American system, from Ben Franklin, Washington, Hamilton, through Matthew Carey, Henry Clay, and then Henry Carey through Lincoln, and then Henry Carey's influence in Europe up through the late 1880s, 1890 with Bismarck. And then the other side of this, the global banker side, which was the British monarchy, the British imperial system, which is what is promoted today by the so-called Austrian school, the gold standard, the anti-credit, the anti-nation state. And one of the things that just stands out, what you just reported, and I'd like to just develop this a little bit, for you to develop it a little more, this idea that Andrew Jackson's destruction of the Bank of the United States was done on behalf of these Rothschild financial interests, which many people see as an enemy, but they see it as a static view. They don't understand that it's the enemy that's controlling their mind.
I think that the one key way to get at this is on the question of the Confederacy and the racial question. Mm. The difference between the Americans and the British system is our intention to unite the interests of people in our nation, and to really ally with other friendly countries to unite the interests of mankind. The globalists are the opposite. They're not for uniting mankind. They are for exterminating people and dividing them on the basis of race, ethnic groups, you know, divide and conquer. And this question of slavery versus and cheap labor and division versus uniting people on their common interest goes back to Hamilton versus his opponents
with the credit policy, the national public debt, and so on.
We had a common interest in a leap forward in our economy, which would unify the sentiment and the interests of our races and our societal segments. And Hamilton, of course, and his nationalists, the Franklin school, the Franklin faction, were explicitly anti-slavery. Jefferson was conflicted on this. He really didn't like slavery, but he was a slave owner with 900 slaves. Jackson was a fool who turned over the world to race tyranny, to the British Empire and slavery. You can see his principles on how he treated the Indians, what he thought about them.
Right.
He had no principles. I wouldn't even call him a racist. He was a fool, but he turned the world over to racial extermination the conquest of India and other things by the British as a world slavery system. We had an alliance with Haiti. Hamilton was an ally of the black slaves who revolted in Haiti and made the Second Republic. And when we purchased the Louisiana Territory from France because they couldn't hold on to it after the Haitian Revolution, Hamilton attributed our Louisiana purchase to the courage of the black Haitians and their defeat of both Britain and France. Invaders.
Obama, by the way, has turned his back on the
exactly.
day following the earthquake.
Exactly. I think that more than simply locating this in the Jackson question, you have to put Jackson as a British stooge in the history. We have had this theme of breakout throughout our history. We had at the beginning, we had a British colonial ban on manufacturing and a permanent war going on in Europe and around the world by the British Empire. This got to a crisis in our revolution. Our Constitution and Hamilton's program posed a solution to this, a system of permanent progress. We got this thing really going, fired up in the 1820s with steam power, iron, coal, and so forth. Jackson and the bankers and their allies, the southern plantation owners, took over in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s to the point where we had another crisis. And the crisis was the slave power destroying the country, ruining the soil in the east, and making us a neo-colonial power going down. The British armed the slave owners for aggression against the United States. We solved that crisis by Lincoln's military victory, rallying the nation. We put forward our American national identity in the conquest of nature, which was.
Well, and I'd like to ask you, because again on this question of the continuity, there's one thing just a minor point, but you said John C. Calhoun initially was with the supporters of the National Bank. What happened to Calhoun?
John C. Calhoun was the Secretary of War for James Monroe. He was a fervent ally of Henry Clay for the American system, for the bank, and for building up our army as engineers who could build up a powerful America, and for the high tariffs. In the Jackson administration, the South was already under the control. Of more and more of the British Party trying to break up the national unity, and Calhoun was under pressure from politicians back in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Van Buren, this schemer snake protege of Burr, was the main advisor to President Jackson, and he schemed to get Jackson to fear and hate John C. Calhoun, and maneuvered to have Calhoun isolated from Jackson. He was thrown. Calhoun was thrown on the back to the power of the oligarchs running South Carolina, who had a whole kind of race war and fear of black uprisings, setting up a kind of a secret police apparatus down there. So he completely changed his tune. He capitulated, Calhoun did, to this new power, this terror down in South Carolina. And from that point on was anti-national. People who simply report on Calhoun as a Southern, anti-nationalist, do not take into any consideration the tragedy of this kind of public pressure. Look, you have a similar thing going on today.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the identity of Americans under pressure since the murder, the double murder of John Kennedy and his brother. What kind of identity are we sinking into? We're sinking back into this Democratic Party of the slavery era, which
mm-hmm.
which Franklin Roosevelt got us out of for a time.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the idea of us having aggressive war against other countries. like we did with the Mexican War in that horrible era. But we now many times that, aggressive war all over the world, a fascist green agenda, where you know, I'll give you an example of how Americans are pressured by, we're not in a democracy now. We're not a free country now. We're under this kind of fear regime that we have to break out of by reassuming this idea of leaping forward from our earlier time. But just to give you an example, February 2nd, there was an article in the Washington Post, the main newspaper of the capital of this country, about worldwide malaria deaths. And there was a graph there which was actually furnished to the Washington Post by an institute on the West Coast financed by Bill Gates. And it showed that malaria actually kills more people than previously thought. And it showed the deaths from malaria starting in 1980 and going up to 2010. And it showed malaria deaths rising over that period and then falling somewhat over the last few years. I asked a couple of high school kids that I tutor to explain why such a graph would start in 1980. One of them said, well, maybe the disease started then.
Yeah.
And another one said, well, probably it's because there was a fairly low level of malaria deaths before that, so it wasn't interesting. Two perfectly natural responses. Mm-hmm. The fact is that if you extend that graph back to, an earlier part of the 20th century, you see malaria killing millions and millions of people. Then suddenly DDT is brought into use in the 1950s. There is a miraculous plunge in the malaria deaths. DDT saved 500 million lives. And then suddenly, when that was banned in the United States and African and other countries were put under pressure by the British and the environmentalists, the malaria deaths rose dramatically. That's not in the graph. How would Americans put up with something like this? This is the deaths of tens of millions of people by a campaign of intimidation of countries not to protect their citizens by killing disease mosquitoes.
Well, this is America today.
This is what's gripping the United States. This is what allows us to say we will go along with genocide even if it kills our grandchildren.
Well, not to mention the lies and deceit that went into the campaign to get DDT banned.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is exactly what you're talking about, this kind of greeny propaganda that goes back to the agrarianism and it goes back to Malthus. Malthus had the same argument as to why you shouldn't clean up stagnant ponds.
Yes, and you should let the poor fester in disease and in slums, because if you take them out of them, they'll have more children.
And Bertrand Russell, of course, in the 20th century had the same argument of needing a black plague every generation or so.
But the counter to this is our accomplishment in modern times, the accomplishment of the American system. Because what Lincoln did against this way of thinking was to mobilize the country. We got steel mills for the first time. We developed chemistry. We developed long-distance railroads. We developed electricity. All of it explicitly counter to the power of Wall Street and London that tried to stop these things, did not invest in them. We had two presidents shot to death after Lincoln, Garfield and McKinley. Wall Street power came back. They allied with Britain for a world war. We had a crisis. We had fascism brought by this London-Wall Street axis. We had a depression. Again, we rallied under Franklin Roosevelt for a military victory against that. We rallied the nation to a new world identity of Americans for development. We developed nuclear energy under Franklin Roosevelt. This was renewed by John F. Kennedy, and we developed space travel under John F. Kennedy. But now, again, this leap forward, this breakout from the otherwise destroyed country that we had under the enemy force of Wall Street and London, this breakout was beaten down to the point where we are now facing, again, the same kind of crisis that in our experience as human beings parallels that what happened to the dinosaurs. And we have this marvelous parallel between this question of whether we will break out as a species and under the kind of guidance that the American system can do, a parallel to the story of our cosmos that's being brought out now by the basement team, by LaRouche. It's in this issue of EIR. We're having the most fantastic new education and the development of research that shows that we have to pay attention to the universe. And just like people in the Dark Ages were sprung out of just paying attention to their local community to say, look, there's a world out there. There's a completely different idea of the cosmos, and you have to pay attention to this. That's reality. That's what we're faced with now.
And, Tony, the work that's coming out of the basement, in fact, goes after the same networks that we're talking about, the British, who created the modern environmentalist movement and who reimposed a form of monetary imperial policy with the post-1971 deregulation in the United States, the privatization, the imposition of the euro system in Western Europe. So today we have the transatlantic system collapsing, and you have the irony that in a nation such as Germany, which benefited directly in the 19th century from its adoption of Lincoln and the American system, Germany today is in a situation where the cold front that's hitting it is causing deaths because there's not enough electric power because they shut down their nuclear industry.
You know, the people in America who have favored the line of bring down the government, they are, many of them are patriots. Many of them are foolish, but patriotic. They are reacting in part to the government being used by Obama on behalf of Wall Street and the British to destroy the country with a green agenda, to destroy the country with the cutbacks in medicine, whatever. The foolishness reflects a paralysis of fear in facing the fact of Wall Street and London as a power aiming at the extermination of mankind. Unless that is faced, you cannot even think about the basic elements of American history. Unless we face what happened to this country from the British and Wall Street murder of John Kennedy and his brother, for example, and what that did to the United States, along with their putting through the permanent war with Vietnam and afterwards. Unless we face that this is the enemy, then we are surrendering to the kind of fear that will kill us and that makes us unnaturally uncaring about our own grandchildren.
You know, it goes back also to the work that was done originally to help set up the LaRouche Pack website, the 1932 video, which showed the difference between the British imposition of Hitler in Germany and the election of Franklin Roosevelt in the United States, and that Roosevelt, through his career, was consistently waging warfare against the same British system and explicitly against Churchill and the imperial policy. And recently we've had a series of videos put up on the website on John F. Kennedy, who also had a very clear understanding of having to fight colonialism. And to the one of the strongest weapons we have is the unleashing of scientific and technological optimism, which was done with the space program, which, of course, Obama is destroying today on behalf of that British imperial power.
I think that If you look at Franklin Roosevelt and Lincoln together, and you think of the surprise to the enemy of the emergence of these men in the middle of the darkest possible crisis facing the United States and mankind, our hope and our work of the LaRouche movement and of Lyndon LaRouche himself is to spring out of this crisis by turning our eyes and the eyes of a younger generation to the stars, to spring out a new leadership that can act in the same way with more vigor and passion to save our country and to save mankind, to reach for the stars, to do what's necessary to break us out. All of our industries, our main advanced industries, have been and are being closed as a policy. Didn't start with Obama. He is simply the guy that puts the last shovelful of dirt on the dead body.
You know, Tony, just I want to pick up on what you just said about this question of leadership, because if you look at what Hamilton did and the group of people that he brought around himself, John Lawrence and people of that sort, who were patriots who were very young and who came from very disparate backgrounds but were certainly not favorite oligarchs. You look at what we're doing today with what was done with the LaRouche Youth Movement and then LaRouche PAC, and you see the capability again that it's in the youthful hope for a better future, that you don't have to be young to have that, but the invigoration, the extra energy of youth is crucial for that, and that's where Lynn is putting so much, in a sense, on the backs of the six candidates, the slate, to provide that kind of voice for the future.
One of the most important aspects of what Lyndon LaRouche has done was, after the Kennedy assassination, when he began this movement, in 2 years after Kennedy's murder, was to launch a looking back at what had happened to every aspect of man's intellect in the previous century or more, to break off the search for man's betterment that was part of our science and our art and our whole culture, our economics. Every field that you have in universities, every field that you have in national life, became dedicated to the extinction of mankind. And whole new fields were created for that purpose, you know, new realms of psychology or sociology or what have you.
Behavioral economics.
Yes, all of this. But we were able to go back and to reassert the primacy, the validity of classical ideas of republicanism, that led up to the creation of the United States, and then subsequently we were able to investigate U.S. history and modern history related to that. Mm-hmm. To show that this tradition that LaRouche has revived, in fact, made what there is of the modern world against the furious opposition of the surviving imperial power that goes back thousands of years.
So, and Tony, you could make another argument there that one of the areas that this is most tragic is in actual history, where, with the exception of handfuls, Graham Lowry and yourself as very notable exceptions, virtually all historians have bought into the worldview, you might say, of the British. And the whether it's in history of science, history of philosophy, or the actual history that you've dug out, there's not a lot. I mean, there are some older historians who have this, but we're really recreating the field of history from this standpoint.
I think you can see a problem in not only in McCarthyism and what happened to people's minds in the 1950s, but the British question is so important in this.
Yeah.
Take a guy like John Kenneth Galbraith. This is a wonderful man, who worked for FDR in his administration, worked for Kennedy later as ambassador to India. A thorough anti-imperialist, a man who believed, he had a great sense of humor, but he really did not understand the British question, and he was born in Canada, and he had this problem, that he looked back at American history through the clouded eyes of somebody who has not sorted out what the damn British Empire is about in its opposition to mankind's survival. He didn't get it. He didn't know that. He didn't get that as Americans did. Then you look at Franklin Roosevelt, and you have a kind of a miracle. Go to his house up in Hyde Park. I've said this before, but it's a lot of fun. You go in the vestibule, and you see his naval pictures on his wall. He was a naval advocate, but all of the pictures are of the Revolution and the War of 1812. There's no modern battleships on the wall, and you have these from the wars against Britain, and accompanied by anti-British cartoons. That's him. That's his point of view. That's who he was. You know, his father had been an industrial man back in the 1870s who had been hired by the Pennsylvania Railroad, by the circles of Henry Carey, to try to build railroads in the South to keep the reconstruction of the South with black rights going and not abandon it back to the plantation owners. That was the deal they were trying to do. And his father was in the middle of that. So these are people who have, just like Lincoln and his friends and his own self-education, people who were able to look back at the previous history of the United States and say, we are giants. We are, what patriotism means is breaking mankind out of the crisis by going far ahead beyond what anyone could dream of. And this was Franklin Roosevelt's hope and work for all the countries in the world, for Africans to do hydroelectricity and nuclear energy, for people in South America and Asia, to build up a modern world and under modern conditions beyond what anybody at the time thought possible, except people of the power of mind of a Franklin Roosevelt or a Lincoln. But that's these people, if you go back to Franklin, this is the type of the American. This is what makes the American what he is. This is, in a sense, the typical American. You could say that a majority of Americans are not typical Americans. The typical American is Franklin. And it's like the question for mankind. Mankind is a creative being who builds cities, who has scientific agriculture, who commands new forces in nature that he discovers their principles. Does everybody do that? Most of them do it if they're hired to do it. But does everybody think of that? No. Is that what mankind is? Yes, that's what is mankind. That's the question of leadership.
And that's the importance of the title of your article, Think Like an American. That if you look at the world today, this British system is broken down. It's broken down to the point where they are moving toward launching what will end up as a thermonuclear World War III as part of their commitment to destruction of population. And so the timeliness of this discussion, this is not just some academic discussion, this question of Hamilton, the thinking of great figures in our history, is something which is imperative for Americans to do today if we're going to survive this very tumultuous period in our own history. But Tony, I'd like to thank you. Again, our listeners, go to EIR, the current issue, and Tony Chaitkin's article, Think Like an American. If you're not a subscriber, become one. You need to think like an American if we're going to survive. And so, Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Harley.
And we'll be back next Saturday with the next edition of The LaRouche Show.